thank you, Mr. Wilson, and all of the various accompanists. Wonderful to have that size of a group to accompany our music. I grew up in a town in Illinois called Danville. So did my father, and so did my mother. One of my father's neighbors had two sons, and in their years, I think it was probably sixth, seventh, eighth grade level, they asked if my father would help walk their two sons to school and back because, you know, they were younger, just thought it would be nice. The older brother was named Jerry Van Dyke. He was 1 year younger than my father. And the younger son was Dick Van Dyke. I have a connection to the Van Dykes because they were in tap dance lessons, and their parents very much wanted them to be in the entertainment industry. And so when my brother and I were born 16 months apart, guess where we spent the first 5 years of our lives? In tap dance school. And we were actually on a television show in Savannah, Georgia, tap dancing, had thousands of dollars worth of costumes, which back in the 1960s was a lot of money. So don't diss tap dancing around me. Please. I remember the Dick Van Dyke show. We would watch the Dick Van Dyke show and we would say, we know that guy, or at least we knew that guy. He came back to my high school a few years ago and got up on stage and did a musical production with all these kids from what's left of Danville. It's like a little Detroit. But I remember when Dick Van Dyke was doing the show with Mary Tyler Moore. I know I'm dating myself now. Many of you are not old enough to remember Mary Tyler Moore or Dick Van Dyke, or for that matter, black and white TV or tube TVs, that whenever they went to bed at night, they were in twin beds, completely dressed head to foot, down to their ankles in thick woolen pajamas. That was back in the late 1960s. News item this week. In Texas, Alabama, and elsewhere, a number of clerks and judges who stated their opposition to gay marriage have thrown up roadblocks to the unions, extending the fight over same-sex weddings 2 months after the U.S. Supreme Court legalized gay marriage. This is from Reuters, by the way. Galvanizing opponents of gay marriage, Kim Davis, a county clerk in rural Kentucky, this week was jailed for her refusal to issue marriage licenses on the basis that same-sex unions conflict with her Christian beliefs. Bible tells us in Colossians, we are not to participate in other men's sins. So what she did is biblically absolutely correct. Others with the power to issue marriage licenses say they would be willing to follow suit, including Alabama probate judge Nick Williams. I feel the same way. This is a cause worth standing up for, said Williams, who ordered the deputies in Washington County not to issue any licenses at all since the court's June decision. This has made Davis a martyr-like figure for religious conservatives who argue she is jailed for her religious beliefs, a view espoused by several Republican presidential candidates. But for legal experts, the gay marriage advocates, they say the issue is clear. It's now the law of the land. In rural Iron County, Texas, the issue of those licenses remains ambiguous. Other places around the country. There are people, well, actually I should say other places around the South. I've not heard of it anywhere except the South. And believe it or not, of all places, if you can imagine this, a Marion County Circuit Court judge is refusing to perform same-sex marriages. You know, when I go back to Cincinnati or back east, which I do far too frequently, people walk up and say, is everybody in Washington really nuts? I mean, we lead the country in same-sex marriage, marijuana, assisted suicide, all sorts of other issues. And I said, no, it's the two big cities. It's basically Seattle and Portland. But here we have somebody in Marion County, fairly close to home, Salem, Oregon. Judge Vance Day is under investigation by the Oregon Commission on Judicial Fitness and Disability because he will not perform these marriages. On August 19th, they applied to the Oregon Government Ethics Commission to establish a legal expense fund to raise and spend money for his own defense. So at least it's sprinkled in a few places across the country. We have some judges, some public officials, very, very few, who are standing up against what is now the law of the land, something that God seven times calls an abomination in his word. My question for you is, how did we get from Mary Tyler Moore and Dick Van Dyke, fully clothed in separate beds, to the place where gay, I mean, it's not even marriage, but by the definition in the dictionary, marriage is between a man and a woman. Definition of marriage is a groom being married to a bride who is a woman. How did we get to this place? What transition took place in our country to where we went from what was not necessarily God-fearing, but certainly a certain amount of character and a certain level of the fear of God and acknowledgement of his laws, to where now, if you talk about God and his laws and the way things should be, you can be ridiculed and put in prison. I want to go back to Genesis chapter 13 and begin with the story of a man you're very familiar with, because we cannot stop the trend of our nation. All we can do is make sure we don't make the mistake that this man made. It started with the violation of a verse in Romans that says, a man should not think more highly of himself than he ought to think. What that normally means is that a man should not, or a woman should not, think they are stronger spiritually than they really are. Sometimes we would like to take on Satan in a wrestling match, and we get ourselves a little bit too close, and we find that we lose because of our own power. We cannot defeat Satan, the devil, and all of his temptations. In Genesis 13, in verse 1, it's a story of Abraham when he was still Abram. God had not given him his blessing yet of his son and changed his name to Abraham. He went up from Egypt, he and his wife with him, and he had with him his nephew Lot. His brother had died, and his nephew Lot had gone with Abraham, or Abram. Abram was very rich in livestock, silver, and in gold. He went on his journey from the south as far as Bethel, to the place where his tent had been at the beginning, between Bethel and Ai. It's the area we today call Shechem, the area where Jacob's well was later dug. If you go to the Middle East, it's very difficult to get in there and visit or to drink from Jacob's well, because it is now completely under control of the Palestinian Authority, and essentially non-Muslims are not allowed in there unless, I guess, there are ways to get in. But we were there several years ago. We were not allowed to see it. It was sort of disappointing. In 1974, when I spent the summer there, we had full reign of the country, full run. You could go anywhere. And we walked over to Shechem and also the Cave of Machpelah and other places, very, very important in the history of Genesis. And they are today off limits for any except the Muslims, except under very unusual circumstances with the right guide, I understand. So Abram was down, and today we call Shechem Jacob's well. He made an altar there not far from Ai, a place that was later to be conquered by Joshua and the Israelites as they crossed over the Jordan. But Lot went with him, and they had too many flocks and too many herds. The area is not full of grass. It does have grass, of course, in the springtime and early summer. But it says in verse 6, the land was not able to support them, that they might dwell together. Their possessions were great. Too many sheep, too many goats, too many animals, too many people to feed. Verse 7, there was strife between the herdsmen of Abram's livestock and the herdsmen of Lot's livestock. So Abram is a peacemaker. Verse 8, he says to Lot, now he could have just said, I'm the older man here, I'm the one in charge, you are my nephew, you go there. He didn't. He said to Lot, please let there be no strife between you and me and between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brethren. Isn't the whole land before you? Please separate from me. If you take the left, then I'll go to the right. If you go to the right, I'll go to the left. And they must have been up on a plateau or a fairly high hill. Lot lifted up his eyes and saw all the plain of Jordan. And so the river Jordan comes down, of course, from Mount Hermon, and it is a very lush garden green area for the entire way that it flows. At that point, the city of Sodom and Gomorrah had not been destroyed yet. Archaeologists pretty much agree that the southern half, or southern one-third, of what today we call the Dead Sea was a plain, probably 10 to 15 feet in elevation higher than it is now. And it was very well watered, with water coming on it from three directions whenever it rained. So it would have been, as the Bible here calls it, like the Garden of Eden. After the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, it looks like the entire southern one-third of the Dead Sea sank about 10 feet in level. And for many, many years, that was a shallow part. You can see the peninsula that comes out on a map. And below that, it was always 5 to 10 feet deep, whereas north of that, much, much deeper. If you've been over there in recent years, so much of the Jordan River has been diverted for irrigation purposes that there is almost no Dead Sea left. It's just kind of a little trickle down to a little tiny lake. I have pictures I took in 1974 on the top of Masada, and then pictures I took about 4 years ago on the top of Masada looking down at the Dead Sea, and it has literally moved miles. There's just mud and dry earth out there where there had been what we called the Dead Sea. But that's something you can see when you get over there. So what Lot was looking at very likely was this southern third of the Dead Sea area, about probably 10 miles by 5 miles, maybe 20 miles by 8 miles. Not large, but certainly a very nice plain. Certainly very, very well watered. A lot of green grass for the animals. A lot of trade. The cities of Sodom and Gomorrah were on a trade route, so a lot of the trade took back and forth in that area. In verse 9, I guess in verse 10, Lot lifted up his eyes and saw the plain of Jordan, saw it was well watered everywhere. Now, this is before the Lord destroyed God of Sodom and Gomorrah. And by the way, that area of the Dead Sea has been mined by the Israelis for 50 years for potash and other elements that would have been created under very high heat. So there's certain archaeological evidence that that was the area of Sodom and Gomorrah. But God says it was like the garden of the Lord. So says it was like the Garden of Eden at one time. Now, Lot chose for himself all the plain of Jordan. Lot should have said, Uncle Abram, you choose what you want. I'll take the leftovers, but they didn't. But Lot liked the idea of, you know, wealth, probably cooler down there in the summertime, all that green grass, all that opportunity to meet and talk with people who were traveling through, you know. So Lot journeyed to the east. So he said, I want to go down to the east. In the King James Version, it says in verse 12, Abram dwelt in the land of Canaan, and Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain. He pitched his tent towards Sodom. That was his first mistake. But it's also possible for you to make that mistake. Because pitching your tent towards Sodom means that you kind of are attracted to that evil, that society. And you think you won't really go over and be a part of it, but you'll be close. You can kind of go over there and, you know, after all, we're strong spiritually. We can do that, right? We can come as close as we want to evil and just make sure we keep that separation there. His first mistake was that he pitched his tent towards Sodom. Sometimes at summer camp we discuss this and tell the campers, you know, stay away from Sodom. Don't pitch your tent towards Sodom. Don't come as close as you can, making the common mistakes that so many times are often dating outside the church, becoming a part of whatever worldly thing that may look attractive. We're not to be taken out of the world, but we are not to be a part of the world. So Lot's first mistake was thinking he could become close to Sodom, but stay outside the city. Because in verse 13, it was very well known that the men of Sodom were exceedingly wicked, and they were sinful against the Lord. So it wasn't any news to him when he found out that they were very wicked and they were very evil in the eyes of God. But Lot chose to live near them, pitch his tent outside the city, and just have a little bit of interaction. Now in chapter 14, you know the story. There were five kings that attacked four kings. These kings were not large kingdoms. They probably had armies in the neighborhood of 300 to 500 apiece. And of course, the bad guys won, supposedly bad guys, because what happened in verse 11, they took all the goods of Sodom and Gomorrah and their provisions and they went their way. And they took Lot. So Lot's first experience, or one of the first ones we know that he had, was that he was captured by these kings. But notice what it says. They took Lot, verse 12, Abram's brother who dwelt in Sodom. At some point, he decided to move into the city of Sodom, staying in a tent outside the city walls. He became comfortable with Sodom, got to know the people, perhaps made some friends, and decided, hey, after all, you know, I'll just move right into Sodom. And guess what happened? He got kidnapped, taken away. One of them came and told Abraham. Abraham gathered all of his servants. God gave him a great victory. And, of course, he rescued his nephew, Lot. It says in verse 16, he brought back all of the goods, also brought back his brother Lot and his goods, as well as all the women and the people. So God gave him a victory. He was able to divide his forces and attack by night. Then in verse 18, he meets Melchizedek, the one that we know today as Jesus Christ, who about 2,000 years after creation had a ministry of some sort there on Mount Moriah in Jerusalem. And he brought out bread and wine, just very similar to the Passover symbols, perhaps even the same thing. Down to verse 21. After the king of Sodom had been brought back, Abram rescued him. He said to Abram in verse 21, give me the persons and take the goods for yourself. So he offered to give Abram all of his possessions. You know, one of the ways that people get influence over other people is to give them a gift, make them feel indebted. If you study predators, those who prey on our children, those who prey on women, those who even prey on people who have a financial need and they know how to get them to do what they want through the human aspect of greed. But the first tool of a predator is to find out what a person wants and then offer it to them, promise it to them. In most cases, they never have to deliver. They just simply have to promise it to them, and they can get control. But first, they have to find out what is the one thing that person really wants. In this case, the king of Sodom wanted to give Abram all these possessions. Now, Abraham already had plenty of gold and silver and animals. He didn't need anything. No one really needs more than what a person can spend. You know, certainly, nobody can eat more than one goat a day or one sheep a day. So Abraham, notice verse 22. Tells you something about Abram's righteousness and his understanding of the need to stay away from those who are selling sin. Abram said to the king of Sodom, I have raised my hand to the Lord, God Most High, the possessor of heaven and earth. That's the Melchizedek, remember, four verses earlier? That's who he's talking about. That I will take nothing from a thread to a sandal strap, and I will not take anything that is yours, lest you should say, I have made Abram rich. Verse 24 says, accept only what the young men have eaten and the portion of the men who went with me. So only what they ate along the way was all they would take. Abram understood not to take anything from Sodom because he did not want to be indebted or connected in any way with the people of Sodom. Now, the next few chapters, of course, talk about Sarah and the coming of the new baby they were going to have. And Abram is blessed again when he's 99 years old. Over in chapter 18, after the angels had visited and the messenger of God had visited with Abraham and Sarah and promised a baby, and of course she laughed, and they named Isaac Laughter because it's what Isaac meant. The men rose, verse 16, from there and looked toward Sodom, and Abraham went with them to send them on their way. So his name is changed here after he was blessed at 99 years old. The Lord said, shall I hide from Abraham what I am doing? Since Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him. So God says, I'm going to tell Abraham what I'm doing. Later, a message, think of Amos, says, shall God do anything, but not first he reveals it to his servants, the prophets. Verse 20, the Lord said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because her sin is very grave. In other words, God says, I have had messengers, these four horses that are mentioned in Zechariah and others, but God has messengers that go back and forth from his throne and tell him what is going on. He says, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry against it that has come to me. So God has received messages from his angelic messengers around the world about these evils that are going on in Sodom and Gomorrah. He says, if not, I will know. And the men turned away from there and went towards Sodom, but Abraham stood before the Lord. Then Abraham starts thinking. And he starts thinking in his head, now wait a minute, if they destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, guess who gets destroyed? my nephew Lot and his wife and a few other people. So he runs after him and he says, well, suppose there are 50 righteous within the city. Would you also destroy the place were it not for those 50 righteous people? And God says, well, okay, I will save the city or spare it for 50. Now Abraham's starting to count. He learns how to count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. He's saying, wait a minute, there probably won't be 50. So he said, well, how about 45? And he started to count again, thought, wait a minute, that's still way too high. And he gets down to 30, and then he gets down smaller, and then he ends up with a number 10. Now, how did Abraham arrive at the number 10? Well, Lot, Mrs. Lot, two married daughters, two sons-in-law, two unmarried daughters, and sons and grandsons. 10. There were 10 people in Lot's family. So God says, okay, if those 10 remain righteous, I will not destroy the place. So the two angels in verse 9, chapter 19 and verse 1 came down to Sodom. Lot saw them. He was sitting in the gate. And what this means is that he was one of the recognized leaders of the city. I've been to the gates of some of those ruins of those cities, and there are these large benches or chairs there where the judges of the city would sit. There's normally a large, kind of a large platform of rock where sometimes people bought and sold. There were meetings of leaders of the council, leaders of the city, where decisions were made. But since he was sitting in the gate, the indication is very strong that he was now a recognized leader or one of the council members, so to speak, of Sodom. So first he pitched his tent towards Sodom, intending to stay outside because it was so evil. Then he moved into the city, and now he has become assimilated as one of the leaders of the city. He recognized them. That's a good sign. He said, "Hear now, my lords, turn in and spend the night with me." And you know the story that the city, we had the first gay rights parade down in verse 4. Before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people from every quarter surrounded the house. So we have the first parade of that type. Lot went with them, and of course they said they have these men. He says in verse 8, "See, now I have two daughters who have not known a man." A verse that certainly calls into question Lot's, you know, character or the panic perhaps that set in. Some explanations are that he knew these men would not be interested in young ladies. But these are daughters who have not known a man. They were virgins. They were not married. So they finally said, "Stand back," and we know what happened. The angels cursed those people with blindness, and then it was time to leave. Verse 12, the men said to Lot, "Have you anyone else here, sons-in-law, your sons, your daughters, whomever you have seen in this city, take them out of this place. We will destroy this place because the outcry against them has grown great before the face of the Lord. The Lord has sent us to destroy it." So Lot went out. Now he's hitting the panic button here. He spoke to his sons-in-law. Now sons is plural, so at least two of them, who had married his daughters. These were not the unmarried daughters, these were the married daughters. He said, "Get up, get out of this place, for the Lord will destroy this city." But to his dismay, the sons-in-law said he seemed to be joking. Now, we don't know if the sons-in-law were married back when he was still living with Abraham. I assume they probably were. Lot may have thought that his sons-in-law and his two daughters who had married them would have recognized the evil of Sodom and not been a part of it. It's also possible they were men of Sodom who had married his daughters while he was there. Whatever, these sons-in-law just laughed at him, said, "Aha, God's going to destroy this place. You know, who is God?" Same thing we hear often today. When the morning dawned, so this went on for all night long, the angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, "Arise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city." It may have been hours that Lot was trying to convince his sons-in-law and his two daughters that he loved very much, and perhaps a son or two or a grandchild or two. He said, "Please leave this city. It's going to be destroyed." And they laughed at him and said, "No, we're staying." The angels finally said, "Take your two daughters, your two unmarried daughters and your wife, and get out of Dodge." But verse 16, he lingered. The men took hold of his hand, his wife's hand, and his two daughters, the Lord being merciful to him, and they brought him outside the city. So they actually had to grab him and carry him outside of the city along with his daughters and his wife. Of course, we know what happened. His wife looked back. She wanted to go back to Sodom. God turned her into salt. And so Lot then left, went up into the mountains. All his possessions were destroyed. Everything he had was gone. All he had was his two daughters, whatever he could carry on his back. Sodom was completely destroyed. In fact, it was turned completely into ashes. Verse 24, the Lord rained brimstone and fire from on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Lord out of heaven. The question used to come up in years past that if somebody was cremated, could they still be in the resurrection? The answer is Jesus Christ said that the people of Sodom and Gomorrah would rise in the resurrection, and if anybody was ever cremated, it was them. Now, this wasn't one of these little kind of cool fires. This was a major hot fire. Who knows how many millions of degrees it might have been, because there was nothing left of the city but just ashes. So his wife looked back. Lot takes off into the mountains. He's lost everything. Most of his family is dead. All his possessions are gone. He's left simply alone, no wife, just his two unmarried daughters. So it cost him dearly to pitch his tent towards Sodom. Let's go over to 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 6. We don't hear any more about Lot, except just a few comments in the New Testament. You know, he wasn't a man who we have his life story of obeying God. We just have a couple comments that he was vexed by being in Sodom, whatever that means. It could mean that he essentially was under attack. He was spiritually very severely damaged while he was there in Sodom. It says in 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 6, turning the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah into ashes, condemn them to destruction, making them an example to those who would afterwards live ungodly. Regardless of what we hear, regardless of all that is pounded into our brains, seems like from dawn till dark, on every channel, in every newspaper, and every radio station, constantly hear talk about gays, gay marriage, homosexual this and that. It's been a bombardment almost like nothing in previous history. Don't forget, God says this is a behavior that is condemned to destruction, making them an example to those who would afterwards live ungodly. He delivered righteous Lot, who was oppressed by the filthy conduct of the wicked. He was almost spiritually destroyed by the filthy conduct of the wicked because he pitched his tent close to it and eventually became comfortable with it. Verse 9, the Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptation and to reserve the unjust under punishment for the day of judgment. Maybe a verse we ought to think about in the coming years. That God knows how to deliver the just out of temptation and to reserve the unjust for their day of punishment. I want to go over now to, Romans chapter 12 and verse 2. We want to talk about the three-step process that has been taking place in our country since Dick Van Dyke and Mary Tyler Moore had their television show. Romans chapter 12 and verse 2 says, don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is good and acceptable in the perfect will of God. We are to prove or test what is good and what is acceptable by the word of God and renew our mind and make sure that we are in line with the perfect will of God. I don't often use the Living Bible or Living Translation, but I like the phrase that it has here in verse 2. It says, don't let the world around you squeeze you into its mold, because the society is trying to squeeze you into its mold. The society is trying to change the way you think about right and wrong, and in fact, they have been very successful at doing that on a national basis. From a book called The Marketing of Evil by Mark Kuplane, he mentions, for the past 40 years, there has been a carefully planned and executed effort to change the way Americans and others think about what is right and wrong. It is vital that you understand what has been going on in an effort to convince you how to think and act. So many people have observed that there is not an accidental but a carefully planned effort to change the way people think about right and wrong. Author and marketing expert Paul Rondo has listed these three steps that have been taking place before our eyes and have been influencing each one of us, whether or not we recognize it or admit it. The first step in changing the way people think about right and wrong is called desensitize. Desensitize. Desensitizing is inundating the public in a continuous flood of advertising and other messages, especially through the entertainment media, presented in the least offensive fashion possible, to the point that everyone is used to the message now and is no longer sensitive to it. The reactions that would have happened 40 years ago to what is now on television, not only in dialogue but in view, hard to comprehend if you didn't live 40 years ago. But today there are things that are commonly, you know, hour by hour, minute by minute, broadcast all across the country and the nation and the world that 10, 20, 30 years ago would have evoked strong reactions. But because of desensitizing and this common, constant bombardment with these subjects, people are very close to the walls of Sodom. In fact, most are inside by now. Desensitizing is what Lot volunteered for when he pitched his tent towards Sodom. But they've been trying to desensitize you and me and every other person alive for the past 40 years. The result is you hear so much about a subject that was at one time offensive and caused a strong reaction that now it does not evoke a reaction of any kind. It's just sort of normal. Now, there are a number of subjects that have been bombarded on the American people, in fact, on the world scene for many years, through the entertainment industry, through music. I remember when music, songs of the Beach Boys, and earlier actually Paisley would mention getting married. Wouldn't it be nice if we were older and we wouldn't have to wait so long? Remember that Beach Boys song? It's about getting married. How many songs now are about getting married? Not many. They're about doing a lot of other things. But by the way, that was not special music. But I know several other Beach Boys songs if you're interested. 409, my 409. I'm just kidding. And I would sing, I wish they all could be California girls, but my wife is a Washington girl, so I would never sing that song. But immorality. Adultery used to be accepted as wrong by everyone. When I was in high school, a girl became pregnant. She was immediately expelled, had to go to the alternative high school. They said the example of having someone walking around unmarried pregnant was so abhorrent to Danville High School, believe it or not, that was not allowed. Today, they have all sorts of special programs to welcome them and celebrate it. It's difficult for people today, young people especially, to comprehend how difficult or how much things have changed. Because immorality was used to desensitize the entire society, it's difficult today to find decent clothing sometimes. We raised two very beautiful daughters. The most frustrating day of every year was trying to find them a bathing suit to wear to camp. My wife would go to Nordstrom, she'd go to JCPenney, she'd go to Sears, she'd go to Target, she'd go to Walmart. Then she'd get mad in frustration and come home and order something online at Land's End or somewhere because you simply cannot find something modest for young girls to wear. Our entire society seems to be wanting to turn them all into immoral young people. Along with the resulting penalties, personally, because of this immorality that has become accepted as normal, we have the natural reactions to that, the natural results, abortion, single motherhood, a welfare society, broken families. The family represents the relationship between Jesus Christ and the church. No wonder Satan the devil targets it so much. Those subjects are almost never shown or sung about as they really are. How many songs are about a mother crying her eyes out because she knows she's murdered her child? Or a single mother who has several children she cannot afford? Or what it's like to grow up in a welfare society in our inner cities? Today we have, quote, homosexual marriage. That's not the end of the story. It's one more step in the march of evil. We already have a society where polygamy, bestiality, and pedophilia have been filed as human rights. After the gay marriage thing happened about 2 months ago, There was a lawsuit filed back east to have those who are attracted to children classified as a different sexual attraction or sexual orientation, and you cannot discriminate against people because of their sexual orientation. So we have those who are attracted to animals. They have a sexual orientation also. And we have those who are attracted to multi-wives. In fact, they have their religions that justify that. There are no longer any limits, no longer any right or wrong, at least wise in our national scene. Another subject that has been jammed, that has been desensitized, is evolution. The belief that all creation is a series of accidents, that there was no creator. It is now the accepted religion in our schools. It is the accepted religion in all entertainment and everything that we hear. The truth about a creator in the Bible account is not allowed to be discussed in many classrooms or in education today. It's a very, very sad situation, but that's where we are. Now, the second step after desensitizing, after they have desensitized you to sin, the second step is called jamming. Jamming. Jamming is psychological terrorism meant to silence the expression of even support for dissenting opinion. You have heard jamming. You have heard people who believe evil is evil ridiculed and made fun of, labeled, called all sorts of names. The way they jam is they label people as hate speech. You can get up and read the Ten Commandments, and you'll be labeled as a person who hates or has hate speech. And I know somebody who works in the high-tech industry down in California walked into a lunchroom where there were people talking with a Mormon who said he did not believe in homosexuality, and they turned to this person and said, "Oh, you're religious. Do you hate all homosexual people too?" And she doesn't hate anybody, but because you believe that this activity that is condemned 7 times in the scriptures, more by the way than murder, murder is only condemned, I believe, 4, 7 times in the scriptures, if you simply believe what the Word of God says, you are labeled as a hater or a promoter of hate speech. So jamming means all contrary opinions are silenced by negative labels. And this is happening to you every day, 24 hours a day if you are on or all the time you're awake and somehow under the influence of either our school system or entertainment industry, which is almost, I think someday God's going to have a lot to say about our entertainment industry in Hollywood or what's on the media. So we have all contrary opinions being silenced. And the third step, after desensitizing people and then jamming all conversation to the contrary, is conversion. Kirk and Madsen said, "We believe conversion of the average American's emotions, mind, and will through a planned psychological attack in the form of propaganda fed to the nation via the media has been going on for these past 40 years. So the average person then is converted to it." You know what is a kind of a, at least to me anyway, a sickening example of this is politicians running for office who are asked about abortion or about, you know, quote, gay marriage. Whereas 20 or 30 years ago, they would have said it's absolutely wrong. I don't want to support it. Now they sort of backpedal and, you know, chew on their words and pretend like, well, it's okay under circumstances, on and on it goes. But they have been intimidated and jammed and then converted. We have people who are converted to the supporting the gay lifestyle. I'm not sure about the Portland area, but up in Seattle every year, the biggest event is the Gay Rights Parade Day when they paint the Space Needle rainbow colors and the governor and all the city officials and the fire police all ride their fire engines around town. I was up there, oh, it's been probably about 6-7 years ago, helping my daughter and her husband move out of one apartment into another one. It was right down just, it was kind of these high-rise apartments just above the Space Needle, beautiful view. And, of course, it's an old building and elevator's very small, but we were carrying stuff back and forth in my pickup. And it happened to be the Sunday that was Gay Rights Parade Day. And there were life forms walking around the streets that I didn't recognize. And so my son-in-law, who was helping me carry his furniture in and out, is a doctor, actually he's a double doctor, a naturopathic doctor plus an MD. And I said, "Isaiah," I said, "what are those 3 things? I said, "That's a life form I don't recognize." He said, "Be glad you don't." I said, well, are they male or female? He said, yes. So it's happening in a way that everybody in public life has to support it. And I think something else we need to know about this marketing of evil in our country is that it is being shared and viewed around the world, not just in places like Europe and Australia and New Zealand, but in far out remote places. And this is where people get their ideas of what Americans are like. In 2005, my daughter Holly went over to Africa to volunteer to work in a hospital in Botswana. And that's cool. You know, my daughter's going to go volunteer to work in a hospital in Botswana. Now, what I did not know was how often she would call from Botswana upset and how often it would cost me $100 for the phone call. So if she calls me one time and I was sitting in my office, she answered the phone, and I thought, Holly, what's wrong? So I said, where's my gun? I'm getting my plane right now. I opened the gun safe. What can I put in the suitcase? Someone's hurting my daughter Holly. I'm going to go save her, right? You know, I could never have done that. But so I finally asked her, what happened? Holly, calm down. She said, I was holding a little baby and it died in my arms. So anyway, bottom line is, it was cheaper to fly over there and see her than to keep paying for all these phone calls. So we took a little trip over to Botswana and had a very good time, really enjoyed it very much, got to camp out in the Okavango Delta and did other things, almost drowned in the Zambezi River, which wasn't the greatest. But my daughter was working part-time at an orphanage for AIDS children. They were probably about 60 little black kids. Entire villages at that time were vacant. We probably rode by 15, 20 villages or 200 or 300 empty huts. Everybody was dead. They all died of AIDS, except the children. And so it was an Anglican church lady that ran this orphanage, and she had the two separate groups. She had the kids that were, it just really is heartbreaking, honestly, because they came out and danced for us and sang and they tried to entertain us. It was a lot of fun. But anyway, so they had about half the kids had AIDS and the other half didn't. And this lady was trying to provide a place for them to stay and try to resettle them in villages that were of the same tribe. But the lady who was in charge of the kitchen became good friends with my daughter. And so she invited us over to her house for dinner. And so, well, that'd be great. You know, go to a real, you know, rural African dinner. So Holly told her we couldn't eat, you know, pork. We had to just eat beef, whatever. Well, she saved her money and she was able to buy beef for dinner. Now, it wasn't steak, it wasn't roast. She said that was for all the rich white people. It was cut up beef intestine pieces made into a stew. So, but to them, that was a very special meal. This to her, I mean, she was saved her money all month so that she could have my wife and I, because she knew we were coming, had this very special, she could actually have beef. So I think that's probably the only time in my life, except when I've eaten hot dogs, that I've eaten beef intestines. But we go to this lady's house, and it's three rooms made out of concrete block, no roof, just sky. I don't know what she did when it rained. But out in the front, she had six or eight car batteries. And they were all tied together in series with, wires. And we asked what the batteries were for. She says, well, that's where she gets her electricity to watch television. So once a week, the guy comes around, a little Toyota pickup, and would exchange charge batteries for the ones that were drained out. And that would give her, I think it was about 5 to 6 hours of watching television. In this house, it had no roof, and, you know, very, very nice lady, though, very, certainly very respectful. I enjoyed the evening very much. So my wife asked her, what do you watch? What do you think she watched during her 6 hours a week? Oprah, Jerry Springer, and Dr. Phil. Basically, it's the parade of human debris and dysfunction, and this is what people in, we're talking rural Africa here, are watching, and they have no other knowledge of America at all. So they think Jerry Springer is what America is all about. So the marketing of evil and the desensitizing and the jamming that has been going on in our country has had an effect around the world. So please don't think that it is just here. If I were to ask you, what are the two holiness chapters in the Bible, what would you say? Our theme the last day of camp this year is that God is holy. And in putting the lessons together, we went through 23 or 24 attributes of God. And we put out the five we thought would be the most beneficial for the campers. But if I were to ask you, what are the two chapters on holiness in the Bible, what would you say? Well, I would say Leviticus 18 and 19. Let's go over Leviticus 18 and 19. Leviticus 18 covers a whole host of sins that God says will get a nation kicked off of its land. And these were the reasons why the people of Israel were kicked off of their land. Leviticus 19 then is a little more specific about how we can be holy like God and things we are to do and things we are not to do. Leviticus 18 stands, starting in verse 1, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to the children of Israel and say to them, I am the Lord your God. According to the doings of the land of Egypt where you dwell, you shall not do. Now, can we just change the word Egypt to the doings of the society in which you live, or the American media, or unfortunately the political land in which we live? According to the doings of the land in which you live, you shall not do. According to the doings of the land of Canaan, where I am bringing you out of, you shall not do, or bring you to, nor shall you walk in their ordinances. You shall observe my judgments and keep my ordinances to walk in them, because I am the Lord your God. You shall therefore keep my statutes and my judgments, which if a man does, he shall live by them, says the Lord, because I am the Lord. The very first of these evils that were done in the land of Canaan and in the land of Egypt is called incest. Anybody ever study Tutankhamun? Perhaps the richest tomb ever found? There are estimates that he was 14 years old and some as old as 17, but that he basically died of conditions caused by incest, because the kings of Egypt only married their sisters and brothers and eventually degenerated, just like many of the crowned heads of Europe, even marrying their cousins. And, of course, very, very common across the Middle East, people marry their cousins, which is one reason why the average IQ in the Middle East is so much lower than the rest of the world. That's well documented. So God says, you shall not approach any of your kin. And the account has about 7 or 8 verses on that. Goes down to verse 11, child molestation. God says, don't you ever touch a child improperly. My wife has dealt with thousands of clients over the years in her work with people with disabilities, and she could tell you some stories that are absolutely heartbreaking, just absolutely heartbreaking. And because of the result of people who have been victims of that, and I'm sure that that's in every audience a man would speak to, there would be those who have gone through that horror. Thankfully, God offers some recovery, but there are always lifelong scars. But I'm not sure how many times I've walked into her office and just found her crying on the phone with some clients because of all the things that have gone on with them. She was in court with another one this last week. So God says you don't allow in any way, shape, or form any child molestation or pedophilia, yet that is already on the agenda of these who want to change our society. Let's go on down. Verse 18. You don't take more than one wife, essentially, verse 19. Then verse 20, you don't go after your neighbor's wife. Verse 21, you shall not let any of your descendants pass through the fire to Molech. So they sacrificed their children to a rock statue called Molech, and we sacrifice ours on the altar of convenience. Almost all abortions are performed because it's not convenient for that child to be born then. No one has ever explained why someone deserves the death penalty because of the circumstances of their conception, but somebody is going to have to answer for that someday. That's never mentioned. They instead use words and terms that make evil sound good. Infanticide and murder of a baby is called choice, or freedom to choose, or woman's health. Never talk about the baby that's losing its life. By the way, in December, probably in January, my wife and I will have 6 grandkids under 6. So I'm sort of, you know, grandchild blessed and also grandchild obsessed right now. So if I mention grandchildren too much, forgive me. You see, a lot of you men need to learn a lesson. You think that menopause is the big change in a woman's life. That's second. The big change, and I've seen this with these eyes, is when you get that phone call that says you are going to be grandma. The world changes. Menopause is nothing compared to the announcement that you're going to be grandma. My wife, oh, I'm going to be grandma. Oh, well, she's going to have a crib. She's going to have a stroller. She's going to have diapers. She's going to have help. And all these trips, it was obsession. It was just unbelievable. I should have done a movie. But it's a wonderful blessing. God says seeing your children's children upon your knee is a great blessing in life. And that blessing can be ours. God promises it to us. But you have to play by the rules, God's rules. Verse 22, you shall not lie with a male as with a woman. It is an abomination. Verse 23 covers bestiality. Verse 24, do not defile yourselves with any of these things, for by all these the nations are defiled. We need to understand we are living in a nation that is defiling itself. Step by step, day by day, advertisement, movie, TV channel, whatever it is, defiling itself day by day. For the land is defiled, therefore I visit the punishment of its iniquity upon it, and the land vomits out its inhabitants. But you shall keep my statutes and my judgments, and shall not commit any of these abominations. The New Testament says, don't let adultery or fornication even once be named among you. And yet we've become so used to it that sometimes we make excuses. We think, well, you know, whatever. But really understand how firm God is on his holiness rules, I think we would all be a little bit embarrassed. For all these abominations the men of the land have done and were before you, thus the land is defiled and the land will vomit you out if you defile it, as it vomited out the nations that were before it. Verse 30, therefore you shall keep my ordinance, so that you shall not commit any of these abominable customs which were committed before you, that you will not defile yourselves by them. I am the Lord your God. Now then chapter 19, as I mentioned, is a chapter about being holy. Verse 2, speak to all the congregation of the children of Israel and say to them, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord, your God, am holy. Remember, Peter said we are to be a holy generation, a nation of priests, kings. Every one of you shall revere his mother and his father. The first step in holiness is the commandment to honor your father and mother. And keep my Sabbaths. Honor God by meeting on his Sabbath day and keeping it holy time from sunset to sunset. Verse 4, do not turn to idols, nor make for yourselves molded gods, for I am the Lord your God. You know, we don't have little idols of Molech in our house. We don't have little idols of Mary or something else. Idolatry is still there. Idolatry is still a danger. But sometimes idols come clothed in nice language, nice-looking clothing, a presentation that seems innocent enough. There are those who claim to worship God, claim to use the name Jesus Christ, claim to do all of those things in the Bible, and they come up with some very creative things that sometimes the people of God who should know the truth get inveigled by. One of the more recent ones, a few years ago, concerned these blood moons. You know, instead of the truth about the commandments and holiness and how we ought to live and forgiveness that's available to us through God, through Christ's sacrifice, instead, we get all of these little side issue things because there are people out there making a lot of money writing books and selling them to people that like to buy books. When I was in Tacoma, that's where this blood moons thing started. There's a pastor up there, a minister named Mark Biltz. I shared a memorial service with him one time. I insisted on going first, which I always do. So I get up and tell the truth, and whatever they say afterwards, they can say. But at any rate, he was the one that decided, he was a former Pentecostal pastor who kind of combined Pentecostalism with Jewish dancing and singing and spouting Hebrew words. That's the best, I think, accurate way to describe the way he's built a big church. But he's the one that wrote this blood moons thing because he was looking at the holy days and discovered that there were holy days that had a full moon. And there were some of these full moons where the earth was kind of closer to the moon than normal. If you understood the holy days, you understand that two of them every year occur on a full moon. This is not some unusual occurrence. Passover and the first day of the Feast of Tabernacles are always on a full moon. And if it happens to be when the moon is closer than it is at other times, well, so be it. It happens often, frequently. But then 2 weeks ago, we had all this smoke in here, and the moon was red, so we discovered the real meaning of blood moons. That means there's a forest fire burning out to the east. But that, plus there's other books out, you know, Bible Secrets to Getting Rich, Bible Secrets to Getting Healthy, Bible Secrets to Why Princess Diana Died in an Accident, on and on and on it goes. People are selling all sorts of little twiggy things to, quote, Christians, as if it's some new idea. It may be new, but it's false. It's heresy. And it's been disappointing when I've come to church and had people run up, oh, did you see this book about the blood? Oh, did you see this book about the secret codes? Oh, did you see this book about this? You know, we can discover how to get wealth. Those are idolatry. Those are a different God than the God that wrote your Bible. God says his truth is easy to understand. It's not high, it's not low. Deuteronomy 30 was a verse 6. It's not too far from you. You don't have to run over and try to find it. You don't have to climb high mountains. You don't have to ford rivers. It's easy to understand once your mind is open. So don't turn to idols, no matter how they are packaged, or make for yourselves molded gods. And it continues in this chapter about not lying, not stealing, not swearing by my name falsely, not to do any injustice, not to oppress the poor, not to hate your brother. Several of Jesus Christ's quotes, like in the Beatitudes, are directly from Leviticus 18. Or 19, Leviticus 19 and verse 18, love your neighbor as yourself. The second great commandment comes from this chapter. It's also the chapter that mentions about not honoring people by the way we look, not honoring false gods by the way we look, not making any cuttings in our flesh, not making any tattoo marks on our bodies. By the way, those are separate statements, not combined together. Very, very clear. Many commentaries bring that out. Verse 30, you shall keep my Sabbath, reference my sanctuary. All of these are about how to be holy. This chapter begins with God saying, this is how you are to be holy. And of course, oftentimes if we pitched our tent towards Sodom, it becomes a fuzzy understanding and we compromise, and before long we find we are living in Sodom. Let's go over to Psalm 101 and verse 3. Psalm 101 and verse 3. So many of the Psalms are prophetic, but this one is more of an admonition, because David learned the lesson that we need to pass on. Psalm 101, I think this is maybe something David wrote quite a long time after his incidents with Bathsheba. Many of the Psalms, especially in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, are written while he's out in that 13 years he was running from King Saul and King Saul's pursuing armies. But these are written a little bit later. He says in Psalm 101, down in verse 2, I will behave wisely in a perfect way. Oh, when you will you come to me? I will walk within my house within a perfect heart. So when he has time alone, when he's in his own house, he said, everything I'm in control of, I will try to walk with a perfect heart. Verse 3, I will set nothing wicked before my eyes. Now, if we were to say today, I will never allow my eyes to see anything wicked, we would almost have to walk around with blindfolds on, because there is so much wickedness everywhere. But there's a difference between accidentally, you know, seeing something you hadn't planned on and planning on seeing it and not letting it affect you. I've often had discussions with people about the type of movies they watch and entertainment. I don't mean to be focusing on just that too much, but how can people watch wicked things and think they will not affect you? Of course they will. With the internet today, there's so much wickedness out there, it's only a mouse click or two away. And yet David said, I will set nothing wicked before my eyes. I hate the work of those who fall away. He doesn't even want to look at it. It shall not cling to me. A perverse heart shall depart from me, and I will not know wickedness. In other words, he's saying, I will not pitch my tent towards Sodom. I will not go over close to it and see if I can, you know, still stay away, but enjoy it a little bit at a time. Well, I want to end today on something very positive, because God always does in the prophets, especially in Isaiah, Jeremiah, and Ezekiel. I'm going to go over to Isaiah chapter 52. It's always a good thing to read the last 15 chapters of Isaiah prior to going to the Feast of Tabernacles, because it discusses not only the conditions of the world we are in, a lot of the evils that are out there, but then also Christ's sacrifice in chapter 53 and some in 55. 55 is quite a bit about the time of the millennium and salvation for all people. But the last five chapters of Isaiah are about the millennial rule of Christ and how wonderful it will be and how things will be so different. Good to focus on before we go to the feast and reinforce that wonderful vision of what the future will be like. In the future, there will not be desensitizing. When Jesus Christ rules the earth, there will not be jamming of righteousness. There will not be jamming of any opinions contrary to evil. And certainly there will not be conversion over to the acceptance of or the endorsement of evil. Because what the world wants of you is not just acceptance, but it wants you to endorse and support and be a part of the evil they are promoting. In Isaiah chapter 52, there's an announcement in verse 1. Awake, awake, put on your strength, O Zion, put on your beautiful garments, O Jerusalem, the holy city. And Jerusalem today is a city in turmoil. It is a city of constant conflict. This year there are concurrent holy days with the holy days the Jews observe and some of the Muslim holy days. In previous years when that has happened, they have had intifadas, they've had riots in the streets, and a lot of conflict. We'll see what happens this year. For the uncircumcised and the unclean shall no longer come to you. Shake yourself from the dust and arise. Sit down, O Jerusalem. Loose yourself from the bonds of your neck, O captive daughter of Zion. It's an announcement about Jerusalem being free, about our entire society being free of the influences of evil. Thus says the Lord, you have sold yourselves for nothing. You shall be redeemed without money. You know, Lot could have easily said, well, Uncle Abraham, I'll take the dry part, I'll go to the west, you take whatever you want. And Abraham probably would have gone a distance away from Sodom. He would not have come close to it. Lot lost everything. Abraham kept his possessions. But here he says, you've sold yourselves for nothing. When you sell yourselves to evil, when you decide to pitch your tent in Sodom and then dwell in Sodom, you'll end up with nothing. Same principle he's talking about here. For thus says the Lord God, my people went down at first into Egypt to dwell there. They were oppressed as slaves in Egypt. Then the Assyrians oppressed them without cause. This was written in the 800s before the Assyrians finally took Samaria. Now therefore, what have I here, says the Lord, that my people are taken away for nothing. Those who rule over them make them wail. It is the rulers and the leaders of the land that are endorsing this march of evil, the marketing of wickedness in our country. We don't have rulers that will stand up and stop it. That's going to change. There will be rulers when Jesus Christ returns that will stand up and will stop it. He says, my name is blasphemed continually every day. Therefore, my people shall know my name. They shall know in that day that I am he who speaks. Behold, it is I. Someday they will not deny that God exists because God's going to be there telling him, hey, I'm here, I didn't disappear, and you are going to change and obey my rules. Verse 7, how beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of him who brings good news, who proclaims peace, who brings glad tidings of good things, who proclaims salvation. Now, Paul quoted this as applying to those who preach the gospel today. In this context, it's about Jesus Christ standing on the Mount of Olives, standing on Mount Moriah, and saying, peace, good tidings, good things, salvation. Your God reigns. Your watchmen shall lift up their voices. With their voices they shall sing together, and they shall see to eye when the Lord brings back Zion. They'll bring forth in the joy and sing together. The waste places of Jerusalem shall be comforted. The Lord has comforted his people. He has redeemed his holy, or redeemed Jerusalem. He has made bare his holy arm in the eyes of all the nations. So today, the power of God is not proclaimed among the nations. It is not the obvious and dominant influence, but it will be. It says, all the ends of the earth shall see the salvation of our God. Then there's a warning that applies to us. It applied to Lot, but he didn't listen to it. Depart, depart, go out from there. Touch no unclean thing. Go out from the midst of her. Go out from the midst of Egypt, of Assyria, of land of Canaan, of the evils of all these places. God says, go out from her, be clean, you who bear the vessels of the Lord. Everyone who understands the truth of God is responsible to bear the vessels of the Lord. The message and the truth of God has been entrusted to you. And God says, if you are to bear the vessels of the Lord, you must be clean. Do not pitch your tent towards Sodom.